Good morning and welcome to the show. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. And on this Labor Day, we're taking the show to new climbs. That is, really cool ones.
Today, we're offering you the chance to catch up on the news and features that taught us how to keep cool. From cool jobs to activities of the cool kids, keeping it cool is the name of the game on today's special encore presentation of the show. And with that,
climate has always been one of Arizona's selling points, but this time of year, it can feel like more of a downside. There are efforts to try to deal with the heat and, in some cases, reverse the warming trends. Over the next few weeks, we'll hear about some of them. We start with Phoenix's new Tree and Shade and Urban Heat Island Subcommittee. Among other tasks, it'll look at how well the city's Tree and Shade Master Plan is being implemented and whether they can benchmark progress on that plan in a way that gets to the goal of 25% of the city under natural or constructed shade. The subcommittee's chair, Sarah Porter, says the panel hopes to be able to make recommendations to the city council by next spring. I recently met Porter downtown. We sat underneath a building's overhang with lots of trees nearby, and I asked her what's the right balance between natural and man-made shade.
I think that's a really good question, and I would say that it depends very much on the space. So here, this is the Buse Center for Law and Society, ASU's new law school building, right in, you know, the smack of downtown. And there's clearly a commitment to incorporate a lot of natural shade as well as constructed shade. And probably this makes sense for this space because this is a natural gathering space. So they seem to have hit a really beautiful balance. But the equation would be different in different spaces. There might be places where it would make more sense to have more natural shade. And I would say that a neighborhood is such a place.
What is the goal with creating shade? I mean, is it really about getting people out and about and walking?
Yeah, it's a combination of different goals. If we just looked at the tree shade, the goal does include cooling neighborhoods, cooling streets, cooling parks. It also includes the benefits of trees, which are sequestering, you know, greenhouse gases and cleaning up the air. Trees are natural filters that help keep the air clean. That has health benefits. Another big goal for providing more shade is that it gives children more months of the year in which they can play, and it gives people more months of the year in which they can walk or run or get exercise outside. With constructed shade, it's largely the cooling benefits that we get. It allows people to go outside more months of the year, and it makes the streetscapes more attractive.
Assuming that the city is able to meet its goal of having 25% covered by shade, how much cooler do you think that could make the city? I mean, what kind of impact do you think that might have?
I haven't seen studies that assign a number to how much cooler it could be. I think there are experts who are working on that assessment. I think what's important for us as people who live in Phoenix is to get our cool evenings and cool mornings back. And the problem with Urban Heat Island for Phoenix is that we don't release heat at night in the way that Phoenix used to, and so we don't cool off.
So hopefully then is the goal that people can maybe first thing in the morning and, you know, maybe as the sun is going down and after the sun has gone down a bit, it'll be maybe less oppressive outside.
Yeah, if it can just get below 90, it makes a huge amount of difference for people. And, you know, I grew up in Phoenix, and kids, during the summertime, kids went out and played at night. You know, it was really the time when we could feel the cooling. That doesn't happen in the way it used to.
When you're looking at constructed man-made shade, when you're, you know, a building like the law school here, really any building, is there a balance that has to be struck between, yes, you're building something that's going to be providing shade, but you're also building something that is, you know, sort of taking away maybe in some parts of town, open desert, or a place that maybe would have been fairly cool absent that building?
Yeah, I think you're right. I wouldn't pick on this building here downtown because, you know, this is a place that's been pretty heavily built. But in other parts of town, buildings do displace natural cooling systems, and impermeable surfaces displace natural cooling systems. So raising the level of consciousness on the part of the people who are doing the designing and the people who are paying for the building is part of the goal of the Tree and Shade Master Plan.
Your committee will also be looking, as the name implies, at urban heat islands. And I'm wondering, how much of a difference do you think that we can make in the urban heat island effect here in the Phoenix area? I mean, is it mitigatable? Is it reversible to some extent? Or are you just trying to keep it from getting any worse?
Well, first off, it would be good if we could keep it from getting any worse, wouldn't it? I've seen some studies that suggest that we have, that Phoenix has probably felt the big impacts of urban heat island, and that we may not be in for more impacts or significantly more impacts. But there are other studies that show that there are things we can do to mitigate urban heat island, to actually reduce the high temperatures. Some examples are cooler rooftops. There are experiments with treatments, like things that are essentially painted onto rooftops that cause them to be more reflective. Same thing with streets. So there are, if you just think about the miles and miles of asphalt that we have in our city, think about how hot it gets during the day. Go out at night, put your hand on it, and feel how it retains heat. Actions that we can take to mitigate against that retention of heat with these impermeable surfaces or with all of our rooftops could have a significant effect in cooling the city.
And as you alluded, incorporating more shade, more trees is maybe a big part, but a part of what can be done to try to mitigate the heat in the Phoenix area, maybe make it a little cooler here in the summer. How big of a part do you think that is? How big of a role can more shade, more trees play, do you think?
It's really hard to quantify without looking at scientific studies, which our commission plans to do. But we all know, from our personal experience every day, that if we have to walk somewhere, I work downtown and I walk out for lunch or walk out for a meeting, we all cross to the shady side of the street and it's degrees cooler. So I think it's hard to quantify what the specific benefits can be because they're so localized. So depending on the types of buildings that are around, depending on the permeability of surfaces, depending on the materials that are used for the buildings that are around, those are all variables that will impact how much cooling effect trees can have. And the concentration of trees and other plants can also be variables that impact that. Some people have a concern about putting in trees because they feel a desire to save water as much as they can. And I've been thinking about that because I think it's a laudable impulse. But my thinking about this is that we make choices all the time about how to use water. And to me, and I think to a lot of people in Phoenix, trees are one of the best things that we can do that use water. You know, we have lots of water use for data storage, lots of water use for manufacturing, lots of water use for all kinds of things. And isn't a tree one of the great choices for water use, especially a climate-adapted tree that's fairly low water use and offers a lot of shade, a lot of cooling, a lot of air cleaning, a lot of beauty per gallon of water?
All right. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sarah Porter is chair of the Phoenix Environmental Quality and Sustainability Commission's Tree and Shade and Urban Heat Island Subcommittee. She's also director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy.
What will your neighborhood look like in 100 years? When you live in the desert, this question is less whimsical and more about simple practicalities. Arizona's Groundwater Management Act of 1980 says that any new development built in the state's active management areas, land that heavily relies on mined groundwater, must prove 100 years of water supply before they're even able to break ground.
Jump ahead to 2018, when the Arizona Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to a planned 7,000-house development in Cochise County. Critics say this could pull too much water from the San Pedro River, one of the last free-flowing rivers in the Southwest. So how did the court square the 1980 law with the potential impact of the rural development's draw on protected water levels? Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services joined the show's Steve Goldstein to explain.
Good morning. And as always, anything dealing with water law is more complex than it seems.
Exactly. So tell us exactly what the 4-3 outcome of this means. And what did John Lopez, who actually wrote the opinion, what did he have to say?
What this comes down to, as you point out, is the question of 100-year water supply. And Cochise County has opted into that. It normally applies only the Prescott, Phoenix, and Tucson areas. And this is a, as you point out, 7,000-home development. And there were some hydrological studies by the developer that said we have a 100-year supply, and Department of Water Resources agreed. The question came up is that this is within 5 miles of the San Pedro River. And back in the 1980s, the federal government created a riparian area and it declared that the riparian area and the Bureau of Land Management is entitled to as much water as they need to keep that river flowing. San Pedro, as you know, is one of the last free-flowing rivers in the Southwest. It depends heavily on groundwater to replenish it. And the question is, how much water does the San Pedro need? How much water does the BLM need? That's still being adjudicated. The argument by some of the environmentalists and the folks in the area was, until you adjudicate that, because they have priority, you can't determine that there's enough water for the development. And what John Lopez said, writing for the majority, is, well, for the moment, that's legally irrelevant, because we don't know how much water. We just have to assume that this Castle and Cook development called Tribute has enough water and is entitled to it, at least for the time being.
Well, so Howie, that for me, that begs the question then, is a 100-year water supply sort of in the eye of the beholder, based on what you just said?
Well, a lot of it is. And in fact, Judge Lopez acknowledged that if it turns out that the BLM is entitled to more water, it may be that the development doesn't have a 100-year water supply. Now, here's where it gets real interesting. In general, you're supposed to tell home buyers, we've got a 100-year water supply and you can count on that. What the court told Castle and Cook is, given this uncertainty, you're going to have to tell home buyers that maybe there's not a 100-year water supply and that perhaps 35, 50 years down the road, you're going to be sucking sand, for lack of a better way of putting it. Now, is that a deterrent to home buyers? It'll be put in the real estate report that is required to go to home buyers. Does anyone read it? Does anyone care? That's to be seen.
Now, we know, of course, how much development has played a role in the Valley's growth since World War II, since after World War II. It's been decades. We've relied on this growth so much. Is this the sort of case that could be pivotal, even as it moves forward, in seeing whether there's still viability when it comes to this, 100-year water supply versus viability of development?
Well, this comes down to a question of what can we count on? In the Phoenix area, we've got access, as does Tucson, to Central Arizona Project water. And the assumption is, well, we've got a 100-year water supply. Now, as we've been reporting now for months and years, that CAP water may or may not be there. So we get into a question that if that CAP water disappears, first for the farmers and maybe for the developers, what happens? Do we have to determine there's a 100-year water supply underground? Do we have to try to retire farmland that's being irrigated with SRP water? Or do we simply say, well, we're just going to amend the law. And there's a crisis coming. We just don't know how soon.
Howie, let me close up with a political question. Of course, we know that with Governor Ducey in office, the number of justices on the Arizona Supreme Court has expanded. Did that play a role here at all?
Actually, in a funny way, it didn't. He's appointed two new justices. One was John Lopez, who sided with the developer in the Department of Water Resources. And the other was Clint Bolick, who said, you've got to be kidding me. You know, what part of consumer protection do you idiots not understand? And was very critical of his colleagues. So if the governor thought he was going to get justices that would all side in the same way, he's sadly mistaken.
Okay. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
Glad to be here.
So, Lauren, I think you are like me. Most of my family is not from Arizona. They ask me all the time, how exactly do you handle the heat?
I'm hoping you don't respond, it's a dry heat.
I have never once said it's a dry heat, and I will take credit for that. I usually do end up, though, extolling the wonders of air conditioning. There are times when it's 100 outside, but you need a light jacket in some of the buildings around here.
Yeah, even in the huge buildings like stadiums or theaters or malls.
Yeah, and what you might not know is some of those major buildings downtown are all cooled by the same system.
Okay, I'm legitimately surprised by that.
Yeah, the Talking Stick Resort Arena, Comerica Theater, the Sheraton Hotel, they're all cooled by the biggest version of an air conditioner you've ever heard of, and it's right under the street. The show's Annika Klein takes us down on a tour.
And here's our guide.
Here, we'll take a tour through the plant.
Gary Cheek doesn't actually do a whole lot of tours. He's the director of operations and maintenance at the NRG Energy Center that sits under downtown Phoenix.
It's pretty much invisible. People have no idea this plant's underneath the street.
They actually have three main plants around here. We're in the convention center plant. and we're looking at what Cheek calls the ice tanks.
The water level in here is about 26 feet deep.
It looks like a really big swimming pool.
For the most part, it's about 32 degrees in here.
It would be a really cold swimming pool, but the temps are perfect for a system that cools more than 40 buildings.
This is a chilled water pipe that's returning from the customers.
It's incredibly noisy right where the action happens, but Cheek is explaining that the blue pipes above our heads are bringing back water from customers. 4 miles of pipe under the streets deliver the chilled water to keep air conditioners blasting cold air. Then the water comes back to be chilled again.
Our water just keeps going around in a circle out to the system, to the customers, and back 24/7, 365.
Where we're standing over the ice tanks is just below the intersection of Washington and 3rd Streets. The people standing above us on the sidewalk can see Symphony Hall, the Phoenix Convention Center, and the Bank of America Tower. All three are customers of the NRG Energy Center.
All of Cityscape is on here, the retail and the office building, a Co-America Theater, 4th Avenue Jail, County.
And their top customer, at least when the Diamondbacks play a home game, is Chase Field.
They'll take about 7,000 tons of cooling. And if you think of your house, you know, the house has maybe a couple of 3 or 4 ton units on it.
And Drury shoots one to left center. That's going to get to the wall.
Fans watching the game behind home plate rely on an enormous amount of cooling capacity compared with those watching on the TV at home. What's more, Chase Field does not insulate its field from the heat of the day. They want the sunshine to come in, Cheek says.
If the ground gets cold, the grass turns yellow. And yellow grass on television doesn't look good for baseball. So even during the summer when it's 115 or 118 outside, they keep the roof open, get all that sunshine and heat on the grass, and then about 2:30 in the afternoon before a 6:40 game, they start pre-cooling.
And by the first pitch, you have happy grass and happy people, a balance that was trickier when Chase Field wasn't connected to a district system 17 years ago. The Diamondbacks notes on its website that the old air conditioning method didn't cool the ballpark down as quickly. That meant they couldn't keep the roof open for as long as they can now. It's also more expensive and burdensome for buildings like Chase Field to run their own systems, to take care of upkeep and upgrades. Whether it's a ball game or a conference, the venues around here are able to keep visitors cool when they need to, but don't have to worry about the system that does all the work. During our tour, we exit the plant through a door, and suddenly we're standing on the carpet in one of the convention center halls.
They're very event-driven, so, you know, right in the middle of the summer, we've had 100,000 people come through here. Doors are open, the cold air's flying out, but inside it stays nice and cool.
Other areas in Arizona have taken a liking to district energy in the past couple decades, too. Tucson now uses a similar system at its convention center. The ASU Tempe and Polytechnic campuses have them, too. And now, thanks to a construction boom, NRG is scouting locations for a 4th downtown Phoenix plant, one that someday more pedestrians and cars will pass over without knowing what's right below their feet. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
It's the show on KJZZ. Thanks for listening on this Labor Day 2018. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And we're presenting a special encore show today, rounding up all of the cool people and tech for you, including ones that fight fire.
Wildfires start as a line of smoke snaking through the treetops into the sky. If no one's around to see it, well, they can get pretty big before help is on the way. That's why lookouts across the state dutifully climb the steps to their posts in isolated towers. There, they scan the tree line for any sign of fire patiently, hour after hour. Believe it or not, in this day and age, this method is still relied on by firefighters and other agencies. The show's Steve Goldstein explains.
At its peak, Arizona had 120 of these towers, and 75 still stand today, according to the Forest Fire Lookout Association, and only about half are used during the fire season. But those that are crucial to forest safety. I caught up with Shirley Payne, a longtime lookout at Baker Butte Lookout Tower. She spoke to me from her post in the tower about her day-to-day job.
We don't just sit up here. We don't just call in fires. We also relay messages to the other Forest Service people on the ground, firefighters. It's right now, it's really intense because we are in such extreme fire danger that everybody's sort of on pins and needles waiting. It's scary because I think it could be a fire season like we had in 2002 or 2011 with the Rodeo Cheniskaya and the Wall of Fire. It could happen. So we're just waiting. Hopefully we get a lot of rain and not so much lightning.
Is that something that you think about all the time?
Oh, yeah. It's a pretty ongoing thing. You almost hate to go down out of your tower afraid you're going to miss something. Because all it takes, doesn't take long for it to take off. Seems to me also that the fires are burning hotter this year. Not so much on the ground, they take off and it's black and brown when the fire's over. Whereas a lot of the fires, it just burns the forest floor.
Can you give us an idea of what you're doing to keep yourself sharp and also just to, in some ways, to pass the time as you prepare and get ready to relay messages or learn what's going on?
Oh, well, that's easy. I keep busy. I read a lot. I do quilting, needlepoint. When I'm feeling tired, I do laps around the tower. 80 times is 1 mile. That means I'm talking about the catwalk on the tower.
Yeah.
I'm not really lonely. I have my dog here. And recently, I have a horse, and my horse stays here with me at the tower.
People are going to want to know what kind of dog you have.
Of course. Black lab. His name is Jeffrey.
that's great. Could you describe the tower?
My tower isn't very tall. It's only 40 feet with three flights. Some are as high as 110 feet, but I am not far from the highway. I'm very accessible. People can hike up or drive up to my tower. Some of the towers are hike-in only. I'm very fortunate. I have a cabin here. Actually, I call it my castle, with hot running water and a shower inside. So I'm pretty fortunate. I didn't always have hot running water. I used to have a pump for years where I had to pump the water and heat it and outdoor shower and all that. But they've improved and I'm uptown now.
When you are in the tower and preparing and doing your work, what kind of tools do you use? Do you have a pair of binoculars? Do you have other things? What do you use to scope out what you're doing?
Well, first off, I do use binoculars, and I do have an Osborne Firefinder, which it's an instrument that's on a pedestal, and it has a 360 degrees, turns around. There's the eyesight. You look through, and you sight your smoke on the crosshairs, and you give them your reading. When you call in a fire, you say, Flagstaff, Baker Butte, Fire Flash, then they'll say, go ahead, and you give them your azimuth reading, your distance, how far away, if there's a landmark. One thing is, it takes a good 6 years to know your tower, and that means all the landmark. And it's changing. It changes all the time. It depends what time of day it is, what time of year it is, the shadows, the clouds. Top smoke is deceiving. It looks like it's close. It could be 10 miles farther.
Wow.
So you always pray you get your distance right, or pray for a cross from another tower. So we triangulate. If several towers see it and they give their reading, then they, in the dispatch office, they have a cross map where they can pinpoint exactly where the fire is, and then they'll dispatch whoever area of response it is and go from there. And then we give smoke updates. Whoever calls in the fire, if it's getting bigger, darker, black, the darker the smoke, the heavier the fuels, light smoke. And also, you know, if you're not sure if it's a fire, you can call it in anyways. It could be somebody's big campfire. But they can always call it a false alarm.
Shirley Payne is a lookout at Baker Butte Lookout Tower, and she'll be up there through this season with her trusty dog, Jeffrey.
On the more high-tech side of the spectrum, there are also people trying to figure out how we can use technology to improve the way we detect wildfires. I caught up with Marong Hu. She's a recent graduate of ASU. And last semester, she and two other students worked on a project that uses artificial intelligence to detect wildfires before they grow. It's a project that hits home for her. When she was still in high school in 2007, she had to evacuate with her parents when several wildfires hit Southern California.
I come home one day and my parents told me that, hey, you know, we're under mandatory evacuations because of the wildfires. School was canceled for an entire week. Work was canceled. We went to stay with our friend in Irvine. And it was just a very traumatic experience because I saw pictures of, you know, my friends who had to evacuate to places like Qualcomm Stadium for a week. We had classmates who lost their homes to the fires. We ended up being okay. Our home was okay. But nonetheless, it was kind of one of those things you never really, you know, we had snow days when I lived in Michigan. Never thought we had fire days, you know, in California.
They're calling the project Prometheus. It took fourth place in the National Microsoft Imagination Cup in May, and now they're going on to compete for $100,000 from Microsoft next month. I spoke with her more about her project and how she and her classmates are now working with local governments to try to put it into practice.
You know, our goal is to have a drone fly over a forest area or a national park or even, you know, a residential area with, you know, a lot of wood. And what it does is it'll map out the area with the camera that's built in. So it'll take pictures, and then those pictures will get fed into a machine learning algorithm that will then look for signs of a fire in those pictures.
So like a small area that is heat or smoke coming out?
Yeah, so how we trained the algorithm was we found all of these videos of wildfires, and then we took screen grabs of the videos and tagged the areas that had fires, and then told the machine, hey, you know, in these pictures, these are fires. And then in these pictures, there are no fires, and fed a bunch of images into that algorithm and had it basically look on its own, determine on its own what was a fire and what wasn't a fire.
Okay, okay. And the idea is that these drones could be kind of flying over the state at all times, sort of monitoring these remote areas?
Yeah, exactly. So the state is very big. The U.S. is very big. And in these drones, they only have a limited battery life. And so that would be great if, you know, they could monitor at all times. But for us, you know, we're trying to be at least a little bit practical with what we're presenting. So we actually, by talking with various firefighters, they told us that they have these red flag alerts that they get from the weather services. And so if an area has very high temperature, very low humidity, you know, high winds, they can deem it at risk for basically wildfire spreading very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now they have certain procedures in place where if they get a red flag warning in that area, the fire department will say, hey, we need more resources to be deployed in the case that a fire does break out. But what we're trying to do is on the preventative detection side. And so before a wildfire breaks out, we're looking at these areas to make sure that we monitor it more regularly than we would otherwise.
So I want to talk now about the ways in which wildfires are detected now. Like, do we generally at this point have to kind of wait until they're really big and somebody notices or reports it?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, that was part of our research for this project, and we were very surprised that most of these wildfires are detected manually. They said that most of it is just reported by people who happen to stumble upon a wildfire. And they also have, you know, lookout towers where there are literally just people standing there with binoculars, you know, looking every which way for fires. And we were so surprised because, you know, we're in the 21st century. This is 2018. We thought there would be, you know, more advanced technology. And they do have some technology, but very little of it is being used, at least by the people that we spoke to. So they have technology, but it's not as common as one would think in this day and age.
Yeah.
And it was funny because one of the things they talked about was heat technology. So they would fly helicopters and then they would have heat sensors to look for fires that way. But they said that in Arizona during the summer when, you know, wildfires are common, it's so hot that they'll just think, you know, the entire state is on fire.
Might not work in the right way. Right, right. Okay. So this is a way in which we could detect these much earlier on, and that could obviously make a big difference.
Exactly.
But there are some challenges with this. You mentioned the battery life of drones. What are some of the other challenges you think that this kind of idea might face?
Yeah, well, the first is the regulations, especially in the U.S. Typically, you know, when we look at, if you just Google like wildfire drone, you can't fly a drone. You know, it's prohibited, right?
Right. They can't send up their planes to fight the wildfire if there's a drone nearby. That's been an issue.
Yeah, exactly. And so we spoke with the Arizona Interagency Fire Center about our idea. they were very excited, but they're like, hey, we have this, you know, like 40-page document of protocols and rules, and it was literally something like procedures for unmanned aircraft and wildfires, like exactly what we needed. And so there, you know, there are a lot of, you know, regulations and hoops we have to jump through. But our goal is to partner with probably the state government. And so obviously they have, you know, if you go through the right procedures, there are ways around it.
So as you look forward, I know this is up for some prizes, some prize money, and you're working with the state now. As you look forward and work on making this a reality, what are your hopes? Like what kind of difference do you think this kind of technology could make?
Yeah, you know, so in doing research in 2017, I mean, these are all estimates, but they said that hurricanes cost the economy about $200 billion, the U.S. economy, and then wildfires were just below that at $180 billion. And, you know, thinking about hurricanes and wildfires, yes, they're both natural disasters, but hurricanes, you have one coming, you can't stop it. You kind of just get away from it and brace yourselves. Fires, if you can stop it in its early stages, you know, because like if you see a small fire, stopping it is at this point, it's not that difficult anymore. Yeah. And so if you don't see it, if you don't detect it, it can spread acres in a very short amount of time. And so if we can have this technology to just detect it, just let the firefighters know where they are, you know, we have the potential to, you know, have a lot of impact, not just for the economy, but, you know, also saving some lives. There are firefighters who risk their lives every day. And the bigger the fire gets, the more difficult it becomes to contain and the riskier it is for firefighters out there.
Yeah. All right. Murong Huh, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Show. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening this Monday, this Labor Day. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. This is a special show for Labor Day. The year 2017 was the warmest year on record in Phoenix, and in January, when we were enjoying high temperatures in the mid to upper 70s, the East Coast was below freezing for much of the month and suffering from one of the coldest winters on record. It's in this context that ASU and the University of Buffalo are teaming up to study how extreme weather impacts American cities, both on the hot and cold side of the spectrum. To talk more about this research, I'm joined by Nick Rakovich, an assistant professor in the Department of Architecture at the University of Buffalo, and Paul Cascio, an assistant professor of landscape architecture at the Design School at ASU. And Paul, let me start with you. Can you describe this work that you're doing? Like, what are you looking at and what exactly are you trying to figure out?
Sure. The name of the project is Building Capacity for Smart and Connected Management of Thermal Extremes. And really what that means is working with cities, integrating different disciplinary perspectives to understand how we might manage temperature in cities. And, you know, thinking about our current state where we have record low temperatures in the Northeast currently starting out this new year, with lots of impacts for people living there and impacts in terms of the hot side in Phoenix. We're really trying to work with both Tempe and the city of Buffalo to understand from decision makers' point of view and also practitioners, what are the most relevant research questions? A key part of this type of research that we're doing is to understand the socially relevant questions that we need to be asking as researchers as we move toward more smart cities.
Nick, to you, what is the benefit of having a really cold, snowy city like Buffalo and a really hot, sunny city like Phoenix working on this together?
When you look at the city of Buffalo, New York, one of the things we, I think, do relatively well is start to deal with things on the cold side. On the flip side, though, we actually don't have a lot of air conditioning in houses in Western New York. And so as we look to the future with climate change, you know, there's a real concern that as we have higher heat days over 90, which I know is not hot for Phoenix, but it's hot for Western New York, you know, how do we start to prepare for that? So by linking up Phoenix and linking up Buffalo, you know, as we've seen, we've had some extreme cold days this winter that have been an anomaly across the U.S. You know, maybe Buffalo has some answers that can help to bear on those issues. And certainly the flip side for Phoenix, where you guys know heat probably better than any other place in the United States.
Do either of you think that there are particular solutions in one city that could be specifically relevant to the other? Like, Paul, are there things that Phoenix does to try to cool things off that Buffalo could be doing the exact same thing for its summers?
Yes, I think there are many lessons already learned here in Phoenix. And so I think one of the things that we're trying to look for in terms of coupling both Buffalo and Tempe is to really understand how that how the cold side should be handled in a more explicit way. And in both sides, because really what we're thinking about is that cities should be managing their temperatures maybe much like they've already done for stormwater and other environmental issues to increase their thermally comfortable zones.
Nick, obviously some of the issues that each city faces are different. I mean, Phoenix will probably never have to worry about roofs collapsing because of too much snow on top of them, for example. But it seems to me that there are some issues in terms of building design and building materials that might be relevant to both cities. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. So if you think about where we spend 90% of our time, it is indoors. So understanding how our buildings begin to respond to these thermal extremes is a really important issue that we're hoping to tackle. There are things that we do in both cities in terms of adding insulation or putting in higher quality windows or upgrading our heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems that can have really positive impacts both on energy performance, but also on how they perform in extreme situations. So, you know, looking at those programs, we call it weatherization in Western New York, you know, looking at what that might do to help get through some of the cold snaps or to get through some of the heat waves, I think is a really interesting thing that we're excited to be investigating.
We hear so much about the concept of resiliency when it comes, especially when it comes to cities and dealing with climate change and dealing with extreme weather events. It seems like this really plays into that whole broad theme.
Yes,
absolutely.
And in fact, the folks from Tempe in particular, the officials that we're working with closely are really trying to understand how the work that we're doing can complement their resiliency plans that they have already in progress.
And the same here. You know, I think for us here a couple of years ago, we had Snowvember where some of our neighborhoods here got over 7 feet of snow. You know, that really started to bring home the issue of climate change and what that might mean in the Great Lakes region. And so we've been at the university trying to get folks tied into some of the other cities in the region to see their work. And, you know, linking this up and learning from each other, I think, is a really important outcome of the project.
Nick, what are some of the practical things that residents of either of these cities, or frankly, any city that does some of these things, might see down the road as far as steps that cities might take to make themselves more climate resilient or try to deal with the extreme climate or extreme weather events on either the cold or hot side?
Sure. So I think you have to take each of these things on a bit of a case-by-case basis. But in general, you know, where we live in the Great Lakes region, we're expecting to see a lot more intense rainfall coming in the 1 to 2 inch per hour kind of storm events. So City of Buffalo and Erie County has been looking quite a bit at trying to include green infrastructure to soak up some of that water from these intense events. But there's a nice side effect of that it also reduces the overall temperatures outside and the urban heat island effect. So finding those solutions that have, you know, multiple benefits are really something that, you know, we want to investigate and also that we want to see how cities are doing this across the United States. So that there's kind of a list of best practices that people might start to draw from.
Paul, that sounds like something that might be of benefit here, especially during summer monsoons when a lot of rain falls in a short amount of time, and also try to reduce the urban heat island effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most definitely. There are a lot of folks that are working in the Valley actively on trying to couple green infrastructure or urban greening or urban forestry activities with other things that are associated with heat. And I think part of this research is also to engage with the cities to understand how we can, through a smart cities approach where you have weather data collection and other types of things, how to actually quantify some of the impacts of those types of designs so that we understand if you plant 100 trees, how much the temperature may be reduced.
I'm curious how each of you think the fact that these two cities, which are at basic climatic opposites of each other, are working together, how does that maybe help amplify the research that you find? Because I think, Nick, for example, those of us in Phoenix have a difficult time thinking of climate change as being really, really cold. And I'm guessing people in Buffalo right about now wouldn't object to an almost 80-degree day in the middle of January. So I'm wondering if the fact that both of these cities are working together on this, does that sort of help give maybe a little more credence to what you find and some of the recommendations that you ultimately come up with?
I hope so. I mean, I hope by looking at some of the extremes, we're better able to prepare for everything in between. And people, I agree, certainly people don't think about climate change as being something where we're going to have a lot colder weather. But as we see changes in Arctic sea ice and some of those weather patterns, we certainly have those possibilities of things we've had like last week.
Paul?
Yeah, so one of the purposes of this grant is to start the process of working with cities on this kind of issue. And so we see this as just the beginning of a much longer relationship between Tempe and Buffalo and potentially other cities that can come together to create an intercity network to tackle these issues.
Yeah, Paul, Nick had mentioned that, you know, looking at the extremes and maybe trying to help some of those cities in between as well. Is that ultimately a goal that, let's say, a place like San Diego, where the weather is pretty consistent year-round, are there maybe lessons that a place like that could draw from what the two extremes are coming up with?
Yes, absolutely. And I think even more as we move toward this idea of a smart city, it could have implications for environmental issues outside of temperature management. And so I think we're cognizant of the fact that this potentially could have lessons learned for other ways to integrate technology and city management.
All right. Paul, Nick, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Paul Cascio is an assistant professor of landscape architecture at the Design School at ASU. Nick Rakovich is an assistant professor in the Department of Architecture at the University of Buffalo. They're each part of a team looking into the impacts of cold and heat in Buffalo and the Phoenix metro area and how extreme weather impacts American cities.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Matt G. I am an operations and ice technician. I drive the Zamboni primarily. I call it a glorified riding lawnmower. When I quit corporate America, I went on Craigslist and just happened to see a job posting for an ice rink worker. Well, I was a hockey player myself from the time I was a little kid playing in backyards and ponds. And I remember being in the locker room in high school saying to my buddies on the team, wouldn't it be cool to drive that Zamboni? And here I am today.
That's Matt Grunauer driving a Zamboni at the Ice Den in Scottsdale. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. We're continuing our special Labor Day show today as we air encore presentations of all the ways the show has kept you cool over the years. The monsoon has been a muse for many, shifting, changing, sometimes teasing us with just a sprinkle, sometimes impossible to tune out. As part of our 2018 monsoon series, we reached out to scientists, architects, artists, and more, and asked them to offer reflections of what the annual storms mean to them. And then one person called us. I'll call him a man of words.
My name is Marcus Wright, and
we asked him to come into the station to do a reading of his poem, Sonoran Rainstorm.
Dust cloud, enveloping space. Horizons disappear. Visibility nil. Atmospheric turbulence oscillating between violent and still. Vehicular travel unwise. Restless inhabitants reluctantly stay confined behind their walls. Promises of Sonoran Rainstorm, so rare. Dust cloud expands, man-made monuments invisible, lights in twilight and night dimmed to silhouettes, their strands swaying in darkened space too weak to maintain linear regularity on cityscape. Lightning flashes and splashes across the sky. Landscape ghosts, mountains in Sahara centuries standing guard as thunder crackles and booms its applause. Promises of Sonoran rainstorm, so rare.
homes without electricity depending now on candle power, telephone and television violently suspended, static bills, and the smell of dust invades the nostrils and the nest. Desert storm time, restful sleep for some, others timid, peek from behind their shutters and blinds. Still, others like me choose to witness and enjoys the show as elements collide. Nature's dance, dark clouds cover the sky, promises of Sonoran rainstorm, so rare. Humidity to the glue, swirling winds stirring the stew, balls of mud dropping splat, 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 lightning zigzagging like razor edges slashing, trees exploding, limbs and light posts crashing, vehicles caught in gully washes, streets flooded and inundated, population mostly mellow, undercover, while television and emergency crews save some lives and tell you the news. Effects of Sonoran storm bringing rain so rare. Black clouds moving slowly, sometimes stationary. Thunder rumbling in the distance, its deep bass underplaying the cacophony of sounds and reverb. Water rolling off roofs in sheets. Lightning illuminating rain. Like countless jewels and precious stones streaming down to the thirsty ground, rain pouring, bathing, saturating. And I inhale ions. Refreshing rain, Sonoran rainstorm keeping promises, renewing and sustaining life. Sonoran rainstorm energizing me. Sonoran rainstorm, oh, so rare.
Originally from Jamaica, Wright has lived in the valley since the early 1970s, and he says, generally, he's happy in his adopted desert home.
I love Arizona, love the Valley of the Sun, but in the summertime when it's 110, 115, you know, I think back in the early 70s when I got here in the early 80s, I kind of enjoyed it in a way, but as I have aged, but it gets oppressive, you know?
So the rains that come after the storms build up almost make it feel like home.
You know, I grew up in the Caribbean, grew up in Jamaica, and so when I get nice showers, I tend to go out and sit on my patio and enjoy it. You know, when the wind swirls and the water sprays on you, it's like, okay, this is almost tropical, and then I like the following humidity, you know? The humidity is good for my tan, too.
He says when the rain comes, he and his two young daughters go out onto their patio and dance.
They enjoy the stuff as much as I do. They dance in the water when it's just pouring down. And this is, you know, after the initial part of the monsoon, once the dust load rolls away and the initial lightning spectacular situation, and then the rain comes, it's like a lot of love coming from the skies. That's kind of the way I look at it, you know? it's just love.
It's just love. And we've heard similar love for the rain from a lot of you who have called in to tell us your monsoon stories. So keep them coming. Call 480-774-8299 and leave us a voicemail. And you might end up on the show, too.
That is it for this Monday Labor Day edition of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry, Paige Phelps, and Marcus Charleston, as well as Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Kaylee Monahan, Tiara Vian, Amanda Liberto, and Olivia Richard. Sky Shout and Jackie High are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hope. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Send us some good story ideas. We are at the show at kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Have a great Labor Day. Thanks for listening.